Well, it was, in those days at Auburn, there was quite a distinguished faculty. One person was Paul Sears and another was Lauren Isley. That was in the 40s. And they both went on. Paul Sears, author of Deserts on the March, mm-hmm. an ecologist long before that word became popular,
yeah.
and Lauren Isley. I remember that after the Lauren Isley candidacy, she was laid to rest next year, I was in some academic conversation with somebody who said...
Remember what year that was?
No. I don't know what year he candidated in.
Yeah.
But I remember somebody saying, someone who knew Lauren very well, saying he just couldn't stay away from the phone. That's the thing. In other words, as provost of the University of Pennsylvania, which was his job at the time, he had an engaged kind of life with administrative chores that he very much enjoyed. This is interesting. I can't quite fit it into the context of those highly stylized pieces of nature writing that he did, you know. He managed to keep that along with administrative chores, as many people cannot. But that's, I'm glad you reminded me of the Lauren Isley thing.
What about the growth of the English department and Cazin's coming? And do you have any idea why he came and why he left?
Well, I don't really. I know he... I am sure he came because forces in the department felt that one way of putting ourselves on the map was to get a recognized figure on the faculty. And this is a motivation which can apply to practically any department. Yes, we are.
We're still at it. And you are on tape.
I have crystallography stories to tell you later.
I know you do. I'll turn this off. English department.
Hiring people in the English department like Alfred Cazin.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
Jack Ludwig was the one who recommended him to me.
Uh-huh. And one of the things I remember about Alfred was that, if not at the beginning, at least somewhere along the line, he fell into the habit of having his special seminar on Friday afternoon. I believe that he made had a kind of special arrangement, if not at first, I say later, of coming in on Thursday and staying overnight at Sunwood, teaching on Friday, and going home then back to New York for the weekend. Or else it was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I don't care. And I know that, of course, Alfred had the room at Sunwood, like he had the secret room, I think, for a while.
Okay.
At least that's all I've heard. I guess only someone of his particular eminence could have offered a seminar on Friday afternoon because he knew that people would come to it. I was always there for it. Pretty well attended. Okay, want me to open that? But I recall one somewhat amusing episode. It was during Herb Weisinger's chairmanship, Herb was a little bit surprised that here we were with our fine offices, but he thought very seldom in them. He sent out a few memos to tell us to be around. It wasn't a matter of particularly that affected me or Tom Rogers because of the particular teaching schedules we had, generally around 5 days a week. But And I remember Herb came around one time to check up, and it was on either a Thursday or a Friday afternoon. He said, "Where is everybody?" And I said, "Herb, there ain't nobody here but us professors." And Kazin, at the office next to mine at the time, said, "Ed Feast, I heard that racist joke." And that ended the incident. But people did then begin to show up somewhat more frequently. As a matter of fact, you know, the scandal continued right down to about 3 or 4 years ago when somebody did a survey and showed that faculty members were posting office hours and not meeting them, not being there. And, of course, on the other side, the charge was, and I know this is true, that many of them kept their office hours and no students came.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved at all in the Yates Festival?
No, I wasn't. I don't know what, don't remember how the chronology.
I think I can get that probably from either Lou Lusardi or Sydney.
Yeah.
How would you estimate the quality of the English department? Has there been any study of it along with other English departments as they've done for the sciences?
If there has been, I don't know about it, but that's not any kind of definitive statement, because the past few years I haven't kept up with that kind of thing.
How do the members of the department feel about themselves?
Well, I think they regard themselves as being in the higher ranks of university English departments in the United States. Not the highest ranking groups, but some certainly above the middle.
Who would you say are some of your brighter lights?
Well, I would choose Tom Maresca.
Maresca.
Yes, who is not only a solid 18th century man, but an expert on wines. Mm-hmm. He wrote the wine column for Newsday.
I see.
And he used to tell me years ago, at least 10, 12 years ago, that we should watch the Italians because they were instituting and enforcing a system which is as rigorous as the French appellation d'origine contrôlée to police their whole wine production.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he is right, was right, and is right, so that Italian wines have really come up in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Lewis Simpson, poet,
Pulitzer Prize, yes.
Mm-hmm. He's a, I should leave that open. One member of the English department, this is a, see if I can put this so it's anonymous, it's not a criticism of anybody, but one person left just recently. That is, he's next year going to be somewhere else. And he left for an institution that I regard as, and anybody else would regard as, distinctly below ours.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could quite properly say, why would anybody ever go to X after
mm-hmm.
being at Stony Brook? Now, one story is that it was housing that made a difficulty for him here on Long Island. And after being around for a few years, he found he could not solve that problem within his means. And
mm-hmm.
you know what the background to that is.
Yes.
At this lesser institution, he not only got a very good deal in regard to teaching duties and leave and so on, but he's also able to live at some distance, 30 miles or so, which is kind of reasonable commute, but where he's not, as it were, in the same city where the institution is which he teaches. And in fact, can live in another university town, which is ever so much better, and use its library. I can see that that's an area within which, in a certain sense, you just can't compete. And I'm sure that must be, there must be many other cases like that.
Faculty housing, along with graduate student housing.
Right.
There are two problems, yes.
Well,
I'd like to have you address the problem of perhaps the situation of a community of scholars, the concept of a community of scholars with faculty members trading ideas across disciplinary lines and having a meeting place and all that sort of ambience. What can you say about that as between Oyster Bay and Stony Brook?
Well, I think it's actually become ever more impossible.
Yes.
In the present situation.
Why?
And I think it's partly because of the kind of institution that we are, located where we are, without a kind of central campus, which is habitable or has some kind of club-like atmosphere or club-like center. You don't have to be like Maury's at Yale and have all the things that people have in New Haven, but you must somehow have something like that. And I guess I come up with the feeling that if you don't have it somehow to begin with, it gets to be very hard, perhaps not impossible, but very hard to develop later.
I see.
Some kind of center. I can think of the number of times I would meet and talk and chat with, say, Van Eisenbutt during the first 10 years we were there. This may be, as in a certain sense, irrelevant, but somewhere early on, when everybody knew that computers were down the road, and a few perspicacious people like myself knew that computers could be used in English and literature, a computer course was offered free to members of the faculty. And I went, and on the first day, Len Eisenbud and his colleagues bounded on me because it was Ed Feast and a scientist, that's all. He said, "What the heck are you doing here?" And I said, "I'm just trying to learn something, fellas, don't jump on me." It was really quite surprising, and it was a most marvelous educational experience for me, because the course was taught by somebody from IBM who didn't know the first thing in the world about teaching. In fact, he didn't even mention the thing which, of course, all the scientists knew, and which I learned only later. It was the binary system on which all computers are based. He didn't even mention things of that sort, but started out on a high level, passed out handbooks and so forth. And the interesting thing that I got out of this experience was that I went back and looked at the things after one week sessions had passed and dimly understood what he was talking about. But when I went back the next, I was more confused, got still more handouts. And I realized that what I was doing was having experience of flunking a course, which I think is a very good thing, because most faculty members don't have that experience when you consider what they are in the nature of things. So that, and then there was one other person finally came into the course who was not a scientist, and it was the a man from the library. Remember the name of the library, which we had a kind of curious
connection with? Basco?
No. Rob Roberto was in my memory somehow.
The library.
He had a name which connected with one of your father's associates down in Mexico. We'll come to it later. It doesn't matter. In any case, he was there from the library, and we found this course absolutely dreary, so we used to greet each other in the hall by holding up our hands in a salute and saying, "Forever more powerful," what was it? Not COBOL, but another one of those languages that they, Fortran.
Fortran.
Forever more powerful Fortran. The red dot means dawn, and that is somewhere along in there. There's question 9 about your expectations when you joined the faculty.
Yes.
And I was being hired at the time, as I think I've told you, as someone who would supervise the freshman composition program.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to Dean Olson at that time. We had a kind of disagreement because Tom Rogers was going to be another person in English under me, and it seems to me that Dean Olson was talking about a program for Tom Rogers and others like him of unrestricted, unvaried freshman composition, no other courses. And I said, don't try that, because I've been there at what used to be known as Carnegie Tech, where the English department was just a little adjunct department, and everybody taught freshman English except a few oldsters who taught an addition every now and then in the advanced composition course. And that's all the English department did, because other aspects of English were taken over by the Gramats. Holy death of a department, so to speak. And I said, to Dean Olson, I'm pretty sure I don't have any of that. And I don't think he liked my saying that, but the point I would make is that if you had told me at the time that I came there to deal with freshman composition, that towards the end of my career here, I would be spending 7 to 9 years as director of graduate studies, the first two of them under Joe Bennett, who was director of graduate studies while I directed the master's program, and then after that being director of graduate studies for both programs, and that in addition, in the last few years before I retired, that I would be for 7 or 8 years the secretary of the Faculty of College of Arts and Sciences, which I held at the same time, I would have been very much surprised. So, in between those, not expectations perhaps so much as the views expand and change, freshman composition on one end of the line and graduate studies at the other.
What did you experience with regard to any evolution in the command of English on the part of our entering freshmen?
I think they improved, not just from those first few classes, but they improved more or less steadily up to a point, I suppose, of some 10 or so years ago. We began to feel, I think, even long before that the television generation was coming in, and that did something to their preparation.
Diminished the vocabulary?
Greeks, possibly so, right. This is even true if you try to get in on their level and learn, for example, the language of surfing, hang ten or whatever it is, and expressions of that sort, and try to lead them back. I think the attention being paid to composition over the last 10 or 15 years, our former member of the English department, Peter Elbow,
yes,
who's gone elsewhere now.
Where did he go?
I don't know. I don't know where Peter Elbow left for, but Peter Elbow was an example of the kind of person who made the teaching and composition respectable, so that he was... He was and is on the board of directors of the Modern Language Association.
Well, so did Tom Rogers.
But no, but if you say, I mean, if you told me 25 years ago that a person with those credentials would be in the Modern Language Association governing group, I think it would have been quite astonishing.
Yeah.
I think that, in other words, the English department group has turned its attention to some of the tasks that attention should have been paid to.
Yeah, that the high school used to do.
In part, yes. I think the high school is doing more of that.
You think they are?
Well, Tom Rogers and I and Homer Goldberg were in various years directors of what was called the NDEA Institutes, National Defense Educational Administration. And what those institutes did was to improve the teaching, supposedly, of promising high school teachers. They were fellows, and they were chosen, about 30 of them in each group from all over the United States. And
came to Stony Brook?
Yeah, they came to Stony Brook, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is a teacher in a local high school.
Mm-hmm.
Is apparently still as good as he was when we had him in class. My post-mortem judgment on the situation is that we had a lot of, we had a lot of applicants.
Mm-hmm.
We had 30 people,
mm-hmm.
and we have 130 applications, at least,
mm-hmm.
200 perhaps. So you choose the best of those.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got a bunch of damn good teachers who don't need any improvement. That's the real problem, and the kind of paradox the situation we were dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
And what we, all three of us, tried to do was to teach these people that you could deal with very difficult literature. For example, in my time, it was Faulkner's As I Lay Dying. And deal with it in front of high school students.
Mm-hmm.
And communicate it. And I think that a lot of those people out there now, with that, I think, mature view of the high school
mm-hmm.
educational situation. So, I've talked long enough.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Ed. This is Mrs. Feese talking about the incidents in their moving from Oyster Bay to Stony Brook in 1960, 2 years before the actual move of the university to the Oyster Bay campus. Go ahead, Natalie.
We were the third faculty family to move. The first ones were the Gardners, and I believe they came in the summer of 1959. Might have been in the spring. The Ramirez's came in January of 1960. They were the second faculty family. And we came in September of 1960 after spending a week at Sunwood. And within a very short time, the Smokers came to a house on Mount Gray Road, which they were... The real estate agent that was showing the house to them after, or they were talking about the house, I think after they agreed to buy it, said that the reason that this wall is this way or that
Teacher is
all wrong. It's because of the explosion.
That's all wrong. That's
correct me. The explosion.
It's not true. It has nothing to do with the real estate agent. They bought the house.
Yes.
They were in it for a whole week and they had a minor plumbing problem. And the plumber came there. And the plumber said, oh, well, you're not going to have any problems here because this is where it's been all new since the explosion. She said, what explosion? And the plumber said, oh, there was a gas problem here, and there was an explosion several years ago, and all taken care of, nothing to worry about. And that was the first they heard about the explosion.
Yeah, because it's a rare feature that there are houses in Oldfield that have
gas.
Direct gas lines, which makes their heating bill much less than the rest of us have to pay. And we used to say, Rosemary Smoker and Bill Ramirez and I, and Beth, Sue Gardner, that we were either the three or the four witches, the four witches of Stony Brook. I mean, we really were early settlers, and we were, the whole idea of the university was so strange to the local. Well, it was so hard to imagine what was going to be here.
Right. You must have had a pretty good imagination in those days.
Well, we knew that it was coming, and we knew that it was not going to be a teacher's college.
Right.
Well, we didn't know what it was going to be.
Yeah.
But it was not going to be a teacher's college.
I used to get firewood from campus, you know, and have our kids assist us.
Or bottle.
Trees will be bulldozed up into great big piles, and then rubber tires, this kind of old tires, will be put on them, and the whole thing will be burned up.
That was when they were clearing the land for.
They were just clearing the land, and it was just terrible. All this darn good wood going to waste. Nobody thought about it. And so I would legal my kids to come out and help me because I said, you can go and you can pick up the pop bottles and the cans and get money for them.
That was in the days when you used to get a deposit, you get a nickel for your bottles before the new deposit law. It was bad luck on the go.
Right. So I was able to get a good deal of firewood for the fireplace.
Right.
End of trivial.
It was for days.
Do you want to say something tonight about
the crystallography?
Crystallography.
There's not that much to say. Sure, I can say it. I mean, I haven't
thought
about it
very much. All right. This is a change of scene. Natalie Feese was administrative aide in the chemistry department for many years, and she will continue to describe an international crystallography conference that was hosted by Stony Brook in the year
1969. Well, it was a very big event. I was hired by, officially, by the National Academy of Sciences, which was using the American Institute of Physics as its fiscal agent, but the official hosts were the chemistry departments of Brookhaven National Laboratory and the State University of New York at Stony Brook jointly. And beginning in the summer of 1966, part-time, I was the coordinator and manager and factotum to prepare for the conference that was to take place on the Stony Brook campus in August of 1969. The international sponsor was the International Union of Crystallography, which meets in different parts of the world every 3 years. Had not met in the United States for 20 years. The meeting preceding the Stony Brook meeting had been in Moscow.
it has been widely hailed and very much remembered by all of the people associated with it because the Russians had put on a very good show with the Bolshoi Ballet and many interesting entertainments. And here we were at Storybrooke with no hotel housing, no faculty dining room, no completed lecture center, 60 miles from New York City, with security clearance problems because we were beyond the 25-mile limit that was approved for Eastern Bloc countries coming to New York City. It was the largest international meeting held at Stony Brook ever. To this day, I don't think there's been as big a meeting as that was. It was a very complicated meeting because it was to take place at principally at Stony Brook, but also at Brookhaven and also in Buffalo. So there were enormously complicated transportation arrangements. Our intention to house all of the delegates in university housing, which was not air conditioned. This was in August of 1969, which could be very hot on Long Island. We had 1,500 people in attendance from 35 countries. For 10 days, we needed to arrange security clearance from the people from the Eastern Bloc. We needed to provide special, formal courtesy arrangements for the delegation of the Soviet Union because the past president of the International Union of Crystallography was the Soviet scientist, Professor Belov. We organized a variety of cultural and social activities in the community. Many people from within the university community and out beyond the university community in the local area were very kind and gave parties to which the delegates were invited, and coordinating all of this was very complicated. I'm happy not to remember the details. There was a special event at the Stony Brook Museum at the Carriage House and the Grist Mill. We did the whole Stony Brook 19th century, 18th century deal. The meeting occurred the week after the United States landing on the moon. And one of the organizers of the meeting and an active participant in the meeting brought with him samples of the moon rocks, which had been superficially studied by X-ray crystallography. It was really very exciting to have that. Our principal speaker was Dr. Linus Pauling. We were anxious about student rioters and student protests because those were the times. And they were indeed, students were out there rioting and protesting. The lecture center where all of the scientific meetings were to be held was completed almost a matter of hours before the opening session. The seats were not installed in the lecture center until the day before the opening ceremony. The student union was not ready. It was very hot. We made arrangements with the Suffolk County Parks Department or the New York State Parks Department, I don't remember, to have a clam bake at Smith Point. And as one of my friends said, it was the wrong shore. because we had to import rocks from the North Shore to take them to the South Shore to have a real clam bake. And some of the park rangers got very upset because many Europeans were changing into or out of their swimming clothes on the beach. And that's against the law. And the clam bake, it rained on the morning of the clam bake. We had to find buses to take all these people from Stony Brook to Smith Point. But the weather cleared and it turned out to be all right after all. The whole thing was a success, but it was a nerve-wracking event. And it was a scientific success. The International Union of Crystallography was pleased with it. The papers that were read were interesting. And the Stony Brook physical facilities were just barely adequate. And they were put to a very difficult test.
Well, thanks very much. You must have been very, very busy.
I was. It was a great experience.
Did you have some grants, financial grants, to do anything with it?
Well, the money came, the sources for funding came from the National Academy, from the American Institute of Physics, from registration fees. We didn't write any grant proposals to fund it. It was still in the glory days when the money came a little bit more loosely from the National Science Foundation also. The subsequent meetings of the International Union, the one after the Stony Brook one was in Kyoto, Japan. There's since been in Sydney, Australia. There has not been another one in the United States since the Stony Brook.
All right, thank you very much.
I'll always remember this. I asked him, we really have to have liquor available for these people and have a bar and have social events. And at that time, there was a rule against alcoholic beverages on any university campuses. And I went to see the president to ask for an exception to make it possible to serve alcoholic beverages to the delegates. And John Toll said to me, this is not something Stony Brook has to be first in. But in fact, he did permit it. But it was really funny. He said, this is not something that Stony Brook has to be first in. And they complained about the heat. And there was one person who said, no, that's not poison ivy. That doesn't matter. Some English pale-skinned person who went after some fern or flower and who must have gone home with some horrible case of poison ivy because they didn't listen to it. And it cost them.
But yeah, that's the kind of thing I forget about. The Sputnik.
Yeah.
And the whole idea.
What about Sputnik?
The Russians had put up Sputnik.
1957.
What? 57 or 8. 57
or
8. And we were supposed now to
respond.
The educational system was supposed to respond. And therefore, for our first 2 years of operation, we were a school that was giving, or going to give, only a B.S.
To be a school for teachers of mathematics and science.
Teachers of science and mathematics.
Right.
That was strongly pushed and became part of the public image, record, and the public image, but it wasn't the actual fact.
So we never
knew. Because we were all hired under the express understanding that this was going to be a four-year college with majors across the board.
And a university, not a college.
No, then the university came along just a little bit later.
Well, but there was an understanding that this was going to be the center of
after another.
That's right.
In the mandate.
That's right. Yeah.
But really, it was the understanding that it was going to be a university. Nobody that joined the faculty in those years would have been willing to come to what was then, what would have been called a teacher's college.
No.
Nobody would have, none of the faculty would have joined anything that was a teacher's college. And so it was always defined negatively.
Yeah.
It's not a teacher's college, yeah. Whatever it is.
Okay. Natalie is reminiscing about Oyster Bay. Now, what was it that you were
You will always remember?
I always remember the way we used to visit what our neighbors, we would take our neighbors to see this extraordinary place of planting fields, and they used to call it Ed's College. Because Ed signed his contract, I think, in April. I can't remember. But anyway, we went up there during the summer before the first class met and before the building was really whatever renovating and changing was done to make it usable. And we, our eyes were falling out of our heads to see the golden faucets and the marble bathtubs and these amazing features of Coe Hall with the antlers and the library and all these things that are a real storybook quality. And our children were fascinated, our neighbors were fascinated. And we all, it was all very leisurely because we thought we had a whole year before there were going to be any students. And then suddenly, boom, students were going to be admitted very soon. But I remember the way the place looked and the Mrs. Coe's bathroom, which later became a seminar. It was so huge, like a closet. And when Ed's office was the valet's office, on the third floor, and it had a balcony from which you could see on a clear day, you could see the Empire State Building, but you had to be careful to turn your head to the right very sharply or you'd bump your head on the beam. And then on short right. And those beautiful trees. And Marlon Brando in the dining room?
Yes.
You have not forgotten Marlon Brando.
Mrs. Cole's cottage.
In Mrs. Cole's cottage. The road?
Yes. I'll never forget telling the children that we were going to live in a cottage. And we got there at night. And after trying to find the place, we were late. And found one of the men, I've forgotten who, what his name was now, and he took us around, and here was this place completely lit with floodlights, and it looked like a kind of palace, you know, and the children were just like...
This is a nice house, Daddy! Well, there are many faculty children who had that experience at Sunwood. Because so many faculty candidates were put up at Sunwood, and their young children assumed that this is where we're going to live now, Daddy. And they were distressed to find they had to find another house.
Well, I did another one. Tenant there, I pulled all kinds of strings, and he came into the humanities division, and I pulled all kinds of strings so he could stay at Sunwood. He came back to me the next day, and he said, "Never again. I don't want to stay in this place. Drums banging all night long. It was like Jane Eyre." Very excited to follow up with your mother in music.
Yeah, well, David Shoemaker had the same experience with the crystallographers. Because when he stayed at Sunwood, there was no room upstairs, and he stayed in what were the service quarters on the lower level, and it was steamingly hot. And it was horrible. It was really slave quarters.
Well,